when I was thinking about the election and I was thinking, if I had one choice, and that was to elect Biden Harris or elect a Democratic president versus removing Mitch McConnell and regaining control of the Senate, consistently I found if I only had one choice, it was control of the Senate. Because a Senate that is willing to do work and not just sit on bills and change the rules to their advantage could overcome a president as misbegotten as Trump. But a president without the ability to have a Senate to cooperate in trying to bring the change that we need in this country, and I'm not even talking about big change. I'm talking about getting out a stimulus package. I'm talking about distributing vaccine and having a national front against this coronavirus. That's really troubling to me. And so for me, this is about, are we going to be able to repair this country and move forward immediately? Or are we going to have to wait another election cycle to be able to begin that work?
Welcome to The Women. I'm your host, Rose Reed. We are continuing with our Blitz mini-season all about my home state of Georgia, profiling the amazing women on the ground whose work will determine the upcoming election for two Senate seats and party control. We are just days away from the election on January 5th, and more than 2.5 million votes have been cast in Georgia, breaking state records for voter turnout in a runoff election. Today, I'm speaking with environmentalist, transit activist, and former Atlanta City Council President, Kathy Woolard.
I'm Kathy Woolard. I live in Atlanta, Georgia, right downtown. I can see the Capitol almost from my house. I've worked in politics my entire career, running the gamut from field work to campaigns and elections, both my own and other people's, as a lobbyist nationally and at the state level, and anything else you could probably suggest about politics from the progressive side of things.
Kathy was the first woman to be president of the Atlanta City Council, and during her tenure, she championed the Atlanta Beltline, which transformed abandoned rail corridors into a greenway and has since garnered over $1 billion in private development for the surrounding areas. Kathy also created Atlanta's first ever energy policy and passed a local ordinance banning discrimination based on sexual orientation, the first of its kind in Georgia. Kathy served as the executive vice president of global advocacy and external relations at CARE International. Kathy does a lot of things in local and international politics, but I became familiar with her work through her weekly bipartisan conversations on Fox 5, alongside Janelle King, who was previously on the show. You regularly take part in bipartisan conversations. You are regular on the Fox local, the Georgia Gang. Can you describe your work in that?
Yeah, sure. The Georgia Gang is a really fun television show. It airs once a week. It's a panel of two Republicans and two Democrats, and then our moderator, Lori Geary, of indeterminate political persuasion. And we talk about Georgia politics specifically.
Can you say why what you do is important to you?
In terms of my work?
Yeah.
You know, not to sound too Pollyanna about things, but I have really cared about public affairs, generally speaking, and social justice specifically, kind of all my life. Some of it because I'm a lesbian and I came out in the 80s and wasn't a great time to come out. So just finding, you know, how I was going to live a life in a pretty oppressive situation was uppermost in my mind. But that wasn't really the first kind of thing I cared about. It was just more self-protective. But I, you know, cared a lot about the environment. I cared about reproductive rights. I cared about race and social justice. My family's from Georgia. I actually grew up with a dad in the military. So I lived in a lot of places, and oftentimes when we would come back as a family to Georgia, I would be shocked at the overt racism and segregation that I witnessed as a really young child, because it was so discordant with my life in other parts, even other parts of the world, where we just didn't experience what was going on in the segregated South at the time.
Right now, we're looking at the Georgia runoffs, and we're seeing a really interesting race. One, because of the unusual circumstances where there are two Senate seats up for election, and also because these two seats will determine the balance of power. What do the runoffs mean to you personally? What are the stakes for you and that you see for your Georgia?
Our country faces unprecedented calamity right now. You know, the coronavirus, economic devastation, so many people who have lost members of their family who contribute to their family, not just as family members who they know and love, but economically and, you know, psychically, who have lost those members. And then, you know, shadowed underneath that is the fact that, you know, we have just experienced the hottest year on record, and that this is really just a foretelling of where we are with climate change. This virus is not some, you know, aberration that just sort of popped up here. And we have to move fast as a country to repair ourselves, and certainly to repair our ability to see each other as a whole country with all of us belonging together. And that's, you know, there's a primary discussion that happens around the country, but particularly here in the South, about racial reconciliation and equity that has got to move fast, both to repair what this previous administration has done, but also just where we are generally.
And as we see Georgia go blue, just by, you know, a margin of about 12,000 votes for Biden over Trump, what do you think will be the motivating factor, or what are some of the variables that we're looking at when it comes to voter turnout for the January 5th runoff election?
God, in some ways, I think our biggest challenge is for people to come through the holidays and recognize that they have to vote on January 5th, right? So I think that's our really biggest challenge. This state is really a reflection of our country. We are completely split in half. I would say that for the last probably 10 years, Democrats have inched forward a percentage point or two towards stasis with Republicans. I think we are realistically about one percentage point away in actual numbers of reaching that sort of 50-50 point. So I'd say we're at like 49, they're at like 50 or 51. You know, it's just, it's that close. We're not quite over that hump. And so it's about turnout. And so that's about whose ground game is the best and who can help average voters understand what's at stake.
And, you know, you made a comment, a lot of Georgians aren't doing well right now. One of the things that we've seen with COVID-19, our governor, Brian Kemp, has been pretty lax and laissez-faire when it comes to mask wearing, opening up the economy pretty quickly. And Georgia has seen over 460,000 positive cases, that's tested positive, and over 9,000 deaths related to COVID. And, you know, the economy is still really struggling to come back, even though, you know, we're quote unquote open. Can you describe that a little bit more?
Sure. Well, a couple things. You know, we have a tremendous racial divide in this state that, if you look at rural Georgia in particular, you have seen the disappearance of jobs, the lack of broadband access, which is now, you know, setting a whole generation of children back in school. You have seen hospital closures. We had two rural hospitals close last month, more on the way. We have one of the highest uninsured rates in the country. Before the pandemic, we're probably approaching 1 million people without insurance. And we've decided, because we don't like the Affordable Care Act 100 million years ago, that we're not going to expand Medicaid so that people who live in rural Georgia will have insurance to pay their hospitals to continue. And so the hospitals are closed. Who wants to locate a business in a county that doesn't have broadband, that doesn't have a hospital, that has, you know, an education system on the brink, and no jobs? And then you compound that by people who are particularly African-American in parts of the state, like the southwest part of the state, you know, who have suffered even more as a result of those public policy decisions. It doesn't shape up to a state that's in good shape. We have the highest maternal death rate in the country. We have the highest rate of unvaccinated children in this country. We have one of the highest rates of infant mortality in this country. Diabetes, lung disease, heart disease, go down the list. Those things occur because we've made public policy decisions recently and in past generations to exclude people. That's what this election is about.
One thing that we're seeing nationally, because so much attention is being turned to Georgia, and, you know, I just want to call out that before we got to this Georgia runoff, we saw four battleground states, Arizona, Colorado, North Carolina, and Maine, really up for grabs. And I think that Maine is really interesting and similar to Georgia for two reasons. And I wanted to get your opinion on this. With Susan Collins's seat, Maine is an example of people who decide, I'm going to go for Biden, but I'm going to stay with my Republican senator. And I think when I talk to my friends in Maine, one of the things that I hear is, we don't like outside influence telling us what to do. I'm very curious to know what you think of the impact of outside influence and outside money on the Georgia voter.
Well, I will say I've done some work in Maine in years past, and Mainers are particularly prickly about this issue. So, you know, they're a little bit worse than we are. I think at the end of the general election, my general refrain in my mind was, let Georgia do Georgia, right? You know, because we have the capability to do this. What has happened in Georgia over the years is because people in other parts of the country have not believed that investment in Georgia and other southern states in particular was a worthy endeavor. We've been resource starved for a really long time. And full disclosure, Fair Fight is a client of mine, but I think, you know, Stacey Abrams has been incredible in terms of both breaking through that sort of ceiling of belief, you know, that we could do this, both from the outcome of her election, but then the incredible organizing that she's done here, and then the incredible organizing that has happened around the country. And so there is more investment in homegrown organizations that have done a lot of work with very, very little. And I'll give you an example. So Georgia Equality is the statewide LGBT organization here. Been around for 30 years or so, incredibly stable organization. They make smart decisions. They execute on what they need to execute on. And a New York Times exit poll from the general election reported that even though the LGBT population in Georgia is about 4.5% of the population by just sort of demographic modeling, it was 7% of the vote. And they had a really aggressive program of outreach to LGBT people and allies through modeling that they've done and tested over the years. You know, people do respond to sort of their own, you know, demographic and cultural groups messages. So investing in local groups that know how to do that and have done this is so much more efficient than coming in and trying to start some new program based on what you did where you lived.
You know, I think that a lot of people are learning that Georgia is, and I think this is emblematic of the South and of our entire country, but it's not land that votes, it's people that votes. So when we look at these swaths of red and blue, we're not really getting an accurate perception of the people and the lives there. I think that Georgia, people who haven't been to Georgia, or Georgia is so much more than Atlanta. How do you describe the modern Georgia?
Wow. I don't know if I can. We are in such a transition right now, and we're a little ahead of schedule of that transition, that I'm not even sure we know who we are. I think in the next 2 years, we're going to see a much bigger transition into what we are. And then as we become a minority majority state in particular, I think that then we have to figure out, well, what does that mean for us culturally? Right? What does that change mean? I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think it's like, what does that mean? What does that mean in terms of public policy? What does that mean in terms of budget allocations? What does that mean in terms of just sort of how we express ourselves? And I think the new Georgia remains to be seen, but we're grappling through that right now.
I really appreciate that answer. And I want to shift to kind of talking about your own personal journey. Could you give kind of an overview of, you know, where you grew up and kind of how you got into politics?
I grew up in a military family. My dad was from South Georgia. My mom was from Atlanta. And my dad, I think, wanted to get out of his small town as fast as he could. So he joined the Air Force. And my great-grandmother was the first female postmistress in the state of Georgia, which is a small fact, but it was impaled into my forehead. And when she died, she left me the rent of a pool hall that she owned that generated $90 a month in rent, which paid my college education, tuition,
wow.
Right? You know, I was the oldest grandchild, and she was determined that I was going to go to college.
Yeah, my mom likes to say, we can't take those journeys anymore, but what will we do about their legacies?
Yeah, that's right. And then because I'm gay, I knew, I don't think I could ever be in the military because I don't follow orders particularly well, but I did believe in public service because of my dad, and so I joined the Peace Corps, ended up going to Micronesia. I came back, didn't really know what I was going to do. I knew I was a lesbian, and then the Hardwick decision in Georgia, the decision that affirmed that the police could arrest people for private consensual sexual behavior happened. And I didn't believe that the Supreme Court would make such a decision, probably a product of my privileged white background, that I thought that they would do the right thing, and they didn't. And so that really propelled me to getting more politically involved. I thought that I was going to do international economic development. I did not think that I was going to do gay rights politics, but I didn't even know that existed as a topic. And so, long story very short, ended up working for the Human Rights Campaign as an organizer here in the South, and then I became their second lobbyist that they hired, and arrived in D.C. in time for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where I learned everything I know about lobbying. And it was a great lesson, very intense. And I was there for about 7 years, and then even though I had the best job I could ever anticipate having, I wanted to come back to Georgia, and ended up running for the city council against all odds. I thought the person I beat was going to lose, and I figured I should get in the race because she should lose to me as opposed to somebody else, and I won.
You upset a 20-year incumbent when you ran for Atlanta City Council in 1997.
And she was very supportive of the LGBT community, and so it was fairly controversial, but there were other political factors that were at play, and I thought that she would probably lose, and there were other people in the race. So I thought that I had, because I had spent so many years working on campaigns and elections, I just thought from the numbers that she could be beat, and so I ended up winning.
And what was the deciding factor? Was it a conversation you had with a friend or a colleague
to get involved?
To do city council versus something else?
Well, you know, interestingly, because I had spent my career up until that point working at the national level and in national coalitions and on national things, I wasn't very well prepared to work on city politics. I just thought that was accessible. I mean, I think you mentioned it. I was the first openly gay elected official in the state. Other people had run, but not won. But I certainly didn't think I could ever run for Congress. I mean, it's just like, that's not going to happen.
Because
I was gay.
Because of being out?
Yeah. And I couldn't not be out because I worked for the Human Rights Campaign, right? There was no putting me back. You know, that was sort of what I was known for.
I still don't. I mean, you say these words, but I don't know if they really like resonate with me, because I'm trying to think, okay, late 90s. Even though we've made so much progress on one hand, it's still something that I feel like when I really let it sink in, to think that the late 90s, that we still, up until that point, didn't have someone who was openly gay on the Atlanta City Council.
Yeah.
And kind of scary to be the first.
Yeah, it was. I think if I had not been working in politics for my career, that it would have been scarier. But I think that I knew what I wanted to do when I got there, right? I knew how to use policy and politics as a leverage for social change. I have a friend in town, Beth Shapiro, who is at the time owned a polling company here. She actually talked to me years prior to that and suggested that I should consider running for office. And honestly, when she said it, I just was kind of like, what? You know, what did you say? And it really kind of hit me like a ton of bricks, you know, like, oh, I can do that? And I think for a lot of women in particular and people who are minorities in general, sometimes it takes that, right? It takes somebody saying, you know, I see that in you and I think you should consider it. Not everybody wants to do it or is suited to do it or whatever, but I think sometimes it takes an external prompt to make you feel like you're good enough to try it.
Right, right. And you almost have to hear it from someone who you think of as like a credible witness.
Oh, yeah. She was a terribly credible witness.
You know, I would call you an innovative environmentalist. You've seen how you can marry bettering the environment with opportunity. And one of the things that has changed in Atlanta profoundly in the last 10 years mm-hmm. is the work that you've done on the Beltline.
Right.
And really mixing residents with commercial property. So you've taken something like a New York High Line and made this incredible green space in Atlanta over historic railroad tracks. But what took place was something that nobody could have envisioned, which is that where people can go and enjoy the outdoors, there can also be an incredible real estate boom and commercial business opportunity that is rich for small businesses, restaurants, bars. How did you approach getting so many different stakeholders and participants to see something that wasn't there?
Well, first, let me just say that the idea of the Beltline, as I worked on it, was the master's thesis of a Georgia Tech student named Ryan Gravel. Ryan and I are friends now still, 20 years later. He found his way to me when I chaired the city's transportation committee, but it was a solution that arrived at the same time that a problem became really obvious. And the problem was we didn't have a transit plan or a transportation plan for the city. We had this incredible resource that was mostly an eyesore and a very challenging thing in terms of its impact, the rail corridor, its impact on surrounding neighborhoods, but also the division that it created between neighborhoods on either side. So it just solved so many problems. And so I approached it with the only tools that I knew how, which was as a community organizer. And so we did for a couple of years, we were everybody's favorite lunchtime speaker, right? We had, you know, I think back then you had like slide projectors, you know, we had projectors and boards and we just kept talking to people about, look, right over there, that hole over there with the railroad track on it, it could be this, it could look like this, it could heal your community, you could, you know, you could, we could make roads across it. And so we asked people, like, what do you want to see on it? Like, when we build it, what do you want to see on it? For me, to this day, this is a transportation corridor. This is about building transit-oriented density because Atlanta's not a dense town. And the thing we kept getting pushed back on about having more transit was we can't have transit because we don't have density. So I was like, okay, well, let's build density right next door to the transportation corridor, and then we will have the density, right? And you don't have to have that much density to support it, but we've now got that density. And so we did all these town hall meetings, and then people started coming forward. I remember somebody from the CDC called and said, well, we're really interested in the public health aspects of it and whether people will, like, exercise more and do stuff, and we want to study it. And I was like, okay, whatever, you know, come on, study it. Well, of course, if you look at the Beltline any day of the week, it's people out exercising, people riding their bike, people walking, people jogging, you know, so, you know, that came true. There were people who wanted public art. We wanted to see neighborhood-based art. The two things that, and there were people who were very concerned about displacement and gentrification, and we were too. The Beltline is a very skinny corridor. There's not really a lot of extra land, right? But there were, I call them like the fat places, where we just have like these little slivers of land that were a little big. You know, to me and to Ryan and the plan, those would be used for really aggressive affordable housing. And what didn't happen, because it wasn't under my watch, is that that land got sold off to the highest bidder. The idea of the Beltline was not a 22-mile pub crawl. The idea was that we would bring to communities what they needed, right? So if you look at some communities that don't have grocery stores, that don't have, you know, pharmacies within walking distance, you know, to provide incentives to put those things there. And that hasn't happened. Too many incentives have gone for yet another craft brewery without any community benefits. And to me, I think that's the big failure of the whole thing. And if I am ever in a position to do something about it, you can bet I will.
Kathy has continued her transit advocacy work while pushing for affordable housing expansion in Atlanta. And since she finished her term as Atlanta City Council President in 2002, she's been working in both city and international politics. And in 2017, Kathy ran for mayor of Atlanta and was defeated by Keisha Lance Bottoms, who has announced that she will seek another term in 2021. When you decided to run for mayor, what was the motivating factor there?
I wasn't really sure I was going to run again. I felt like I had something to offer in that moment in time. And we, you know, we're coming off an administration that, you know, has been under investigation. Many people have, you know, pled guilty and gone to jail for ethical violations. There were 13 candidates in the race. I came in third. I feel like we ran a really good campaign. I didn't win, and I hate that, but, you know, you can't win if you don't try. So
you came in third. However, the top three candidates who came in were all women.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And I think it also shows the viability of the women, of the female candidate. That's the election that Keisha Lance Bottoms won and became mayor. I feel like this is like a good time to ask fellow white women, what is the point where we get behind our Black female candidates and kind of come together as a coalition of women? How do we reconcile that with our own ambitions?
It's something I think about a lot. I think what we have to really ultimately get to, and when I was alluding to sort of what kind of Georgia we're going to be, I think I mean this in some ways. Right now, we're very focused, and I have been focused in years past on making sure that we elected more LGBT people because I was the first person at the table, and that was, you know, interesting, you know. So I recognize that who's at the table matters, and I support that wholeheartedly. And I don't think we're there yet, either as a city or a state or a country. And I don't know, you know, if I'm going to be active enough in politics to help get to that point. I think we have to walk through the moment we're in about who's at the table before we can walk through the moment about what's on the table. Atlanta's not a progressive city. Let me just lay that right on the lines. We are a very conservative city. We are never first in innovation. We are never first in helping solve the plight of anyone that is suffering. We have the highest level of income inequality in the country. We have an affordable housing crisis. We have a transportation crisis. And we have a very old school way of selecting our leadership, which has not served people who don't play in that game well. So my feeling is we do have to get to a place that what we're talking about is what the agenda is. What are our goals as a city, as a state, as a country in building an equitable economy, of addressing climate change before it destroys us all, you know, of moving forward in a way that recognizes the future, and then selecting candidates that can get us there. But I think we have to get there pretty quickly.
You know, when we look at these Georgia runoffs, I mean, one of the things that is really, interesting to me is that with the balance of power in the Senate, it will determine the trajectory of our foreign policy. How do you see this playing out, and what are some of the things that are really top of mind for you?
I think restoring the U.S. position as a multilateral player is really, really important for global security. And Trump has taken all that off the table. And so we have walked away from friends. We have become incredibly inconsistent in our behavior. And so I think that, again, having the Biden-Harris administration bring us back to some semblance of international policy that can be determined. I don't know what our international policy is these days other than destabilizing everything. Come back to the table on so many things, certainly on climate change, but on trade and on human rights issues. And then, you know, also thinking about, you know, it does no one in this world any good for people to live in abject poverty and misery. It just doesn't. It destabilizes the world. It causes, you know, mass immigration and refugee issues. And so we have to figure out how do we help share resources in the world so that people can live productively, you know, where they're from, you know, because I think most people choose that when they can. So I think, you know, it'll be interesting.
You know, many cis and straight folks operate in the world and in their professional lives, never addressing who they love or what their orientation is. And as a trailblazer, you have often and frequently spoken, as we've been talking about, the first openly gay elected official. And it's something that you reference. Does it get tiring for you?
Yeah. It's really tiring. I feel like I'm so much more, and that I have contributed a lot, both nationally and locally, to the advancement of those issues. I've participated in virtually every issue of significance to the LGBT community to date. So I don't feel like I have to like review my credentials in that regard. But as I mentioned, you know, I am very much about concerned about the state of the environment and climate change. And I have from the time I was in high school. I'm an avid backpacker, and I really like to be in nature. That's kind of my only other hobby besides politics. So when I ran for Congress, it's kind of funny. So, you know, that was like my third campaign. And, you know, I just was like, can I just like not be the gay one all the time? You know, like it's undoubtedly there is no putting me back in the closet by any stretch, whether you look at me or read about me, you know, and someone wrote an article that called me an environmentalist. I about cried. I was like, oh my God, somebody finally sees me. Like I that is what I am. Like I introduced all kinds of environmental legislation at the city of Atlanta that goes unheralded because nobody thinks that of me, but it was a lot of stuff to address climate change and our built environment and was really significant to me and really groundbreaking at the time. And so I thought, oh, you know, I saved the article because I was like, wow, the only article ever written about me that referred to me as something besides the gay one, you know? And so I'm very proud of that. And I'm proud that that was the way I was described, right? You know, because it could have described me as who knows what else, you know? Might have been good, might have not been good, but it was actually what I cared about. You know, so, you know, I get asked to do a lot of things as sort of an LGBT person, and I try to do it really as often as possible, but sometimes I get really tired of it. You know, I feel like there are so many other things that I know about, that I have expertise in. You know, nobody talks to me particularly much about what I know about international economic development, and I know a lot, and I'm really passionate about it because they don't see past, you know, the gay.
This is my lightning round. I say we like to go light after we go deep. It's called Truth or Truth. So just, you know, quick, fun questions for you. But given that you are a transit advocate, what is your favorite mode of transportation?
Well, when I have a choice, well, I do like to ride my bike. I really hate driving. So my bike would be the most immediate one. But in a city, not Atlanta, that has real transit, it's transit, light rail, streetcar.
And if someone was coming to Georgia or Atlanta for the first time, what's something you would tell them not to miss?
I would tell them not to miss the Beltline, but I would tell them to start on the west side.
And to all the young people who are listening who are really passionate about climate change and are trying to get older people in their life and other people who are less enthusiastic, what's one piece of advice that you can give them to get other people on their bandwagon?
Never give up. We absolutely have to reverse the course or to stop the course of the direction that we're going in. And I never thought, my 20-year-old self, that I could marry a woman. My wife and I have been together for 33 years. I never dreamed that was possible. I never thought, you know, I wouldn't go to jail for being gay. I never thought I would be elected. For young people who are working in social justice movements, same thing. Just keep moving. There will be setbacks. You will lose, you will win. But, you know, I look back after 35 years and, you know, things that I scoffed at 30 years ago have been achieved. But, you know, have a strategy and be smart about it.
And to those who are trying to come out to their families and their loved ones, what's one piece of advice you can give them?
Oof, good luck. It's really hard. I think that's the one thing that has never gotten easier. I think you have to accept yourself. And I didn't do this, but I would say give people the grace to be able to go through what they need to go through to accept you. You know, I mean, if it took you some time, it took me some time to come to terms with being a lesbian. Of course, I didn't get to watch Will and Grace and see Ellen DeGeneres, but I had to sneak around the library to figure out what I was. But, you know, it took some time for me to be able to feel comfortable with that. So you have to give the people that you are surprising with this information time to understand what it all means for them. It's hard to do because, you know, it just is. But I would say the sooner you can come out, the sooner your life starts.
I want to thank you so much for your time and for your generosity of spirit, for your work on Atlanta, making my hometown like so much better and so much the place that I see it to be. And thank you for your time on this interview.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. And it's great to meet you. And call me when you're in Atlanta.
I will. On our next episode in our series dedicated to the women on the ground in Georgia making an impact on this historical election is Park Cannon, the first openly queer state representative in the United States. And we'll hear from a 90-year-old Reagan Republican on why she's flipping for the upcoming election. And thanks to Caitlin Bearer for reading today's credits.
Hi, Caitlin Bearer calling from Denver, Colorado. The Women is a production of the host, Rose Reed. This episode was mixed by Adrian Lilly. Thanks to our team, Gail Reed and Nora Kipnis. Special thanks to Ashley Fielding, Lori Geary, and Wendy Zuckerman, and to Jen Chapon and Harley Bosco. You can find the show on Instagram at The Women Pod. If you have questions about voting in Georgia, visit georgia.gov. There will be more episodes leading up to the January 5th elections and the key women on the ground. So check back in a couple days. Thanks.